Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The controversy over evolution and creationism is one of the longest-running conflicts between science and religion. This morning, in this hour, we will review one of the latest ideas to emerge from this battle, intelligent design. And our guest will be one of the most vocal opponents of intelligent design creationism. His name is Robert Pennock from Michigan State University. He's professor of history and philosophy of science at Michigan State. He's on the faculty at Lyman Briggs School of Science. He also has appointments in the philosophy department, Department of Computer Science, and the Ecology, Evolutionary Biology, and Behavior graduate program. He served as an expert witness in the Dover School Board case, where the court ruled that intelligent design was a form of religion and teaching it in public school was unconstitutional. He's written many articles on the subject of intelligent design creationism, also the books Tower of Babel, The Evidence Against the New Creationism, and also another Intelligent Design Creationism and Its Critics, Philosophical, Theological, and Scientific Perspectives. He speaks regularly around the country on these issues, issues of science and values. He was here on the campus in the spring, and unfortunately we could not have him on the program when he was here physically on the campus. We wanted to have him on the show. And finally, we are making that happen, and we're glad that he could be joining us. He's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments, and we just ask that so we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving along. But of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. Or if you might happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Pennock, hello.
Hello there, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
I'm glad you could give us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let me ask you this question. I think in one of the books, a couple of the books that I looked at, you make the observation that over time, most of the conflicts involving religion and science have been resolved for the most part. But this particular one, the evolution-creationism conflict, just won't die. It will not go away. And so that begs the question, why?
Well, this is the sort of thing where time heals wounds. And although it's true that from our perspective right now, this seems to be something that just won't die. In fact, I think that probably it will die in the same way that the other kinds of apparent conflicts have gone away. I mean, one can go back to historical conflicts that in their own particular period were every bit as divisive as this is now. And we look back on them and are rather amused. Why would it be that Christians would be threatened by the idea that the Earth goes around the sun? Today, I think there are relatively few Christians who think that's a problem. Well, not entirely gone, though. There are some creationists, actually, even today, who are still geocentrists. But for the most part, this is just a non-issue. There are just a range of these kinds of points where, at one period, religious believers thought that they had to take a stand, and then over time they realized that their faith really did not hang upon this conflict with science and accommodated it. And I think that really in time the same will be true of the creationist controversy as we see it now. And in fact, I think that we're seeing more and more religious voices coming out saying that this is not a necessary conflict.
Well, and I think it's interesting that just as recently as last week, there has been a shift, seemingly a significant shift in Kansas, which was a state that was a focal point for this kind of controversy, where now less than a year after the Board of Education for the state adopted science standards that were probably the most aggressive in challenging evolution, their voters there on Tuesday ousted the conservative majority on the board that favored those guidelines. So it seems that we are seem to be now seeing a movement back kind of in the other direction, where now we have people who are going to be going into the board who are more interested in getting back the kind of science curriculum that existed there before. So it seems that now we see a sort of a counter movement. And I suppose what one sees with this controversy is that over time it sort of goes back and forth. It peaks, then it settles down, then it peaks again.
Kansas is one of these teeter-totter states on this issue. The standards that they were drafting back in 1999 would have been model standards for science and for evolutionary biology. And that was when the first controversy in Kansas occurred, when creationists on the board stripped out from the draft of the standards really all mention of evolution, and including not just evolution, but things having to do with the age of the Earth, even erosion. They didn't want any thought that that eons of time might have shifted the geography of the state. They didn't want students to think about that. That was the time that the Kansas issue came to the fore in the first place. And then there was an election that voted out the school board members. But then in the next election, some of them were voted back in, or other creationist supporters were voted back in. And now we're seeing, again, a reverse of that. So the recent vote, I think, is a reflection of public attention. Once sensible voters realize what's going on, then they wake up, they vote. And really, I think, in Kansas, what one sees again now is a resurgence of the sensible conservative view, which is that science is fundamental, biology is fundamental, and evolution is fundamental to biology. So that's the kind of standards that I think we'll get back in Kansas now, and that's great.
One of the things that you explain in your writing, particularly in Tower of Babel, is that there are different kinds of creationism and creationists. They don't all agree. They disagree on some rather fundamental points, things like how old is the Earth, what precisely was the role of God in creation, and so forth. So having said that, though, is it possible to give some kind of umbrella definition of creationism that would adequately cover all of the different varieties that exist?
Sure, and that's a good point. The way in which people generally think about this issue is very much colored by the previous battles that had occurred, really in the early to mid 80s. This is when creationists politicized their movement and tried to get what they at that point called creation science into the schools. And creationism under the guise of creation science was such a big issue, there were several court cases, including ones that went up to the Supreme Court, that's the kind of creationism that most people think of under the term creationism. But creation science is really just one form of creationism. They had a number of very specific theses that they held to. For example, a recent inception of life on Earth, a recent Earth itself. This was the 6,000 to 10,000 year old Earth. The calculations for this were based upon, you know, looking at Genesis, looking at the generations, and you can extend things back to 10,000 years. That's what they took as their basis. They thought that there was a global flood, and so this is sort of the view that most people think of now as creationism. But really, it's just one form. Creationists themselves differ with regard to the proper biblical interpretation of the age of the Earth. It doesn't say anything there. There's no dates given, and it actually used to be the case back at the time of the Scopes trial that creationists then accepted an ancient Earth. And the young Earth view is in a way a more recent view. Mm. So that change from old Earth to young Earth is seen again and again among creationists. Is the flood universal, catastrophic, or was Noah's flood perhaps local and tranquil? Creationists argue among themselves vehemently about these kinds of issues. And so it's a mistake to sort of think of just the creation science position as the only form of creationism. So to answer your question more generally, what is the general form of creationism? It's really just the idea that biological evolution, as science has discovered it, is false, and that the real explanation is some supernatural one, some intervention by a transcendent being.
Hmm.
And then the details of that differ. We, again, often think primarily of the Christian creationists, but there are creationists from other religious traditions as well who have differing religious views about the origin of the earth. Their creation stories differ. There are Native American views that are anti-evolution, but of course they don't agree with the Christian view of creation. And similarly, other religious views can also have a view that rejects evolution in favor of some supernatural intervention, and that's what makes them a creationist view. And it's important to keep those in mind as well, because they do play a role, although a smaller one. In Kansas, just for example, in that 1999 case, the main folks who were supporting the revised standards, that's to say the creationist standards, was a local creationist group that held to a young earth view, but they were supported by the intelligent design creationists, and they include people who have young earth and old earth views. But there were also some Hare Krishna Hindus who supported that change because they wanted to have their own Hindu view of creation put in this place. So it's important to keep these other views in mind.
Well, then, so having said that, then, what distinguishes intelligent design theory from other kinds of creationist thinking?
Really, the way in which intelligent design creationism got its start was in the wake of these decisions, these court decisions that I had mentioned. The creation science approach had been tested in court, and really the Supreme Court in 1987 said the fact that you call it science, creation science, doesn't make it science. And appealing to a transcendent being makes it religion, and that violates the constitutional separation of church and state. And in 1987, the creationists said, well, creation science isn't going to work for us anymore. We need to have a new approach. And intelligent design was born out of that retooling of their view. They wanted to drop the association with the term creation science, and really they want to be seen as science in a new light. And this approach was crafted really by a law professor, Philip Johnson, who I think looked at those rulings and said, how can we try to get around them? And intelligent design was crafted very carefully to remove the explicit references to the age of the earth, for example, to a global flood, in order to make it less likely that it would be identified with a very particular religious view, make it less obvious. And what intelligent design creationists do is agree to disagree among themselves. They say, we're going to set aside the issue of how old the earth is, and we just won't mention that now. After we get into the schools, then we can have a great time talking about that. That's what Johnson says in one of his books. But strategically, it doesn't work for us to talk about that now, so let's set that aside. So it was essentially a negotiation and a strategy born out of that loss in the courts. But really, if you look at the content, you'll see that the concepts behind intelligent design are really the very same creationist concepts that we saw before, in many cases, the very same arguments, but just given new names. This was one of the things that came out very clearly in the case recently in Dover, Pennsylvania, where we were able to look at draft materials of creationist textbook, the key intelligent design textbook. And you can see that, in fact, all they did from one early draft, from many early drafts, was take out the term creation science, creationism, and replace it with the term intelligent design or design, but leaving the rest of the definition the same. So really this is a relabeling more than anything, a strategic relabeling. And that's what the judge in Pennsylvania, Judge Jones, saw very clearly. He said this is creationism relabeled.
I'm getting some callers lined up here, so I want to get to them in a moment. Let me ask one other question. The folks who advocate the teaching of intelligent design in public schools, their argument is that there are competing ideas about the origins of life. There is evolution, there is intelligent design, and they say, why not present both of those sets of ideas? And their argument is, you know, lay them both out and let the students hear them and evaluate them and go from there. Is there some place somewhere in the curriculum for some discussion of this controversy and the various kind of arguments that different people make? So is there no place for that, or is there some place for it, and you would argue that perhaps that the science curriculum is not it, or is there some way within the science curriculum that you would look at this controversy?
Well, there are a couple of things in the way you sort of presented their argument quite accurately that I think we ought to talk about first, which is this notion that they appeal to of fairness, right? They're competing ideas. Isn't it fair to teach both of them, let the students decide? That's a very appealing notion to Americans generally. And it's really one of the most common arguments that you'll see creationists make, some appeal to fairness. But the thing that's wrong with that has to do with the notion that it's fair to teach something as science that isn't science. Okay, it's really, in fact, quite unfair and misleading to students to say that there are these two different theories, scientific theories, and that we ought to teach both. That's the way that you put it, and that's the way that they put it. Mm-hmm. We ought to teach both of them. In fact, these are not comparable views at all. Evolution is a very well-established, as I said, fundamental part of biology, whereas creationism isn't science at all. And so it would be a real disservice to students to present something as though it's a competing idea, a competing theory, when in fact it's nothing of the kind. I think this would ill-prepare students for any understanding of what real science is. And I think it also misrepresents religious views as well. It pretends that a particular religious view, and a view that thinks of design as requiring a particular way of happening and ruling out others, it's unfair to religions that don't hold that view to put this forward. So I think that actually this is bad science and bad religion. And that parents who want to give their children their own religious education would be opposed to these sorts of proposals as well. Essentially, it's making a particular religious view, promoting it as though it's science, and saying those other views aren't proven, whereas ours is. This is just bad news from both points of view, I think.
Our guest is Robert Pennock. He's professor of history and philosophy of science at Michigan State University. He has published a number of articles and several books dealing with intelligent design creationism. And he speaks regularly around the country on issues like this, also generally issues of science and values. He was an expert witness in the historic Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School Board case that in 2006 ruled that intelligent design was not science, but was religion, and teaching it in public schools was unconstitutional. We have several callers. The lines are full. People will help us, can help us, if they try to be brief in their comments so we can get as many people as possible in the program. We're almost at the midpoint already. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Bloomington, Indiana, the first caller, line 4. Hello.
Hi, David. You have Mr. Pennant on, advocating life without intelligent design. I assume you will soon schedule a guest advocating intelligent design, won't you?
We would consider that.
Oh, good. May I suggest Michael Behe? Or Dean Kenyon of San Francisco State University. Either of those would be fine. Now let me address your guest.
Mm-hmm.
I want to describe some basic requirements of life.
Could I actually just say something with regard to that? The way that you characterized my view here was that I'm advocating life without intelligent design, and I wonder what makes you think that the intelligent design view in its particular form. You mentioned Behe and Kenyon, and those are two of the standard intelligent design advocates.
Could you speak up? I can hardly hear you.
Why one would think that is the only view of what design could be from a religious sense?
Because
the standard creationist view rules out the possibility that God did creation through evolution. That's a theistic evolution account. That's a standard view, and that's not life without design. It's saying that design happened through evolution. So an evolutionary biologist is not saying that there is no design. An evolutionary biologist is saying we're investigating the way in which we can discover the processes, the natural processes, and then are neutral with regard to whether there was some transcendent designer or not.
That certainly is not the way that most Darwinists are talking. For instance, Richard Dawkins said that Darwinism made it possible for an atheist to be intellectually fulfilled. And Julian Huxley, the greatest advocate of evolution in the last century, said the reason that evolution was so eagerly accepted was because the idea of God interfered with our sexual mores, unquote. So there's a kind of an antipathy toward God in among the evolutionists.
I think that's quite false. If I could just interrupt, I'm sorry. That those two quotes are the ones that are repeated again and again and again by creationists. Literally half of the articles that are written on this by creationists quote those two people. Certainly Dawkins' quote is used all the time. And they're by far on the extreme of this. If you take a look at the general scientific view, you will not find that that's representative. And so I think you're misrepresenting what evolutionary biologists hold. There are religious believers in among scientists, just as there are in any other field.
Oh, that may be, but I just want to it's a very simple question. I'm going to give you a few requirements for basic life, and I simply want you to describe how they can occur by accident. And the first one would be you would argue you would agree that there is no such thing as a simple living organism. The least complex one-celled organism would make a supercomputer look like child's play. How does that kind of design complexity occur by accident?
So there are a couple of things I want to say here just about the way the question is posed to show the kinds of confusions that occur.
Just answer the question.
You're focusing on the origin of life, and evolutionary biology, certainly as Darwin discussed it, and you keep using the term Darwinist, is not focused on the origin of life at all. In fact, Darwin said that his book was not at all concerned with that issue. That's an interesting scientific question, but it's not part of evolutionary biology. And so to focus on the origin of life as a criticism of evolutionary biology is sort of an apples and oranges kinds of issue. So I think that that by itself there sort of starts off this in the wrong kind of way. It's not a criticism of evolution.
I think I'm just hearing you admit you can't answer the question.
I'm just saying that the question doesn't have anything to do with evolutionary biology per se. It sounds
well, let me ask you another one
question.
Then. All life requires DNA because the DNA molecule contains the instructions to make and operate any living organism. I don't believe DNA occurs naturally outside of a living cell, and even if it did, it wouldn't persist because it's unstable. So where did the first life get its DNA?
The other thing that I just want to mention here is again, this misunderstanding about what evolution says. It's not the case that evolution requires DNA. Darwin's view is something that is a very general view, and this is actually something that's quite an interesting new application of Darwin's discoveries. Darwin's view really can apply in any system where you have a self-replicator, and DNA can do that, where you can have inheritance of the pattern in that replicator, where you can have mutation of the pattern, okay, that's to say new variations arising, and where you have natural selection. And you can implement that kind of a system in any other kind of substructure. It doesn't have to be DNA. And we're now able to do this.
Give me an example. Give me an example of life without DNA.
And we can then
give me an example
see how it is
DNA.
That evolution, in fact, works in the way that Darwin said it is. You can use
give me an example of life without DNA.
Bring about complexities.
A simple question.
Sorts of complexities that, in fact, the person that you mentioned, Michael Behe, says is impossible to occur. You can see this happening.
It's a simple question. Give me an example of life without DNA. One example.
You could have just a basic RNA life, and that's the idea of Thomas Keck, for example, is of an RNA world where you have RNA as the precursor rather than DNA. And in fact, when
an example,
we start looking
please.
At life and the definition of life, then it's not clear that we would even expect it to be DNA. Think about what NASA is doing in its search for life on other worlds. We don't expect necessarily that life on other worlds would be based upon DNA. It might be based on some other chemical.
Now,
there
really
isn't anything that
Let me just jump in here because I have a lot of other callers. I'm sure the caller there would like to continue. If you want to make one final comment, I'll give you the chance, but I really have to move on.
Okay, just one final comment. Even if you had RNA, even if you could give an example of life that needs only RNA, once you have the RNA, you're not home free. You've got to have a whole lot of complex mechanisms to read and follow the instructions in RNA, and those mechanisms only occur inside of living cells. So in order to have those mechanisms work, you have to have a living cell first.
As I said, if I could just... perhaps just repeat what I said before, that again, this changes the discussion. This is not part of Darwin's view. He was talking about what happens after life arises. It's not an issue of the origin of life. It's an issue of the origin of species. That was the title of his book. And the claim that intelligent design creationists make is a claim that says Darwin's mechanism, that's to say, the one that I described, variation, random variation, subject to natural selection, that cannot, in principle, produce biological complexity. They talk about, Michael Behe, for example, talks about irreducible complexity. And this is just the same sort of thing that the caller was speaking of, and says natural processes cannot, in principle, produce these things. And that's just false. We can see that happen. We can do this experimentally. We can watch how that process that Darwin discovered can produce complexity of this sort.
Well, I want to thank the caller and go on. The next is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. When you mentioned that one of the people proponent of intelligent design was a law professor, it's obvious that this is not a question of intelligence only or scholarship or discipline. And I'm finding all along that the hardest thing to understand is how each side of this debate views the other. They are so strongly set in their particular view that it's hard, I think, for each side to understand the other. With that said, you've had obviously more dealings than most with people who propose intelligent design. And I was wondering how you understand them and their views. Let me give as an example. In reading about this, often creationists will say, over the last 160, 70 years, little by little, more and more evidence as experiments, observation, more and more understanding of the process of evolution has come up. After all, as you said, Darwin didn't know about genetics, never mind DNA information processing. But he had observations of geology, morphology, and all the rest of that, and proposed a theory of step-by-step changes. Well, when a creationist says in a debate, I now, based on 160 years of experience, have a faith or a feeling or a sense that as we continue to explore, we'll know more and understand better. At which point, the creationist will say, well, there you go. You have used the word faith, so obviously your system is as much a faith-based system as ours. They can actually say that we're on a par, because one has to use the word faith, optimism, expectation, that further work will yield further design. In any event, that was the example that I think of when it's obvious the two sides don't quite understand what the other is saying. So from your experience, if it's not a question of intelligence or discipline, obviously the last caller is much more well-versed than I am in details. How is it that you found the people who propose a creationist view, how is it that they view their world, their place in it, and how they view the evolutionists? I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but
yeah, let me try to answer that, and then you can tell me if I haven't done it satisfactorily.
Thanks.
The thing you're focusing on is something where you say that it looks as though there's a way in which the two views are on a par, that scientists talk about some faith that they will solve problems, solve unanswered questions. So I think that kind of language is actually not used as often as one might think, and when it is used, is really misused. That scientists don't say we have faith in our conclusions. What they say is we have evidence for our conclusions. At least that's what they ought to be saying, and I think most of them do say that. And they will readily admit that there are unanswered questions. The origin of life is one such question where scientists will say, well, we just don't know yet. We have a lot of interesting hypotheses. We have a lot of interesting data. We have some really exciting developments. But we don't know the answers about this. There are plenty of such unanswered questions in every science. And what scientists typically say there is, we don't know yet. That's an ongoing research question. We'll continue to search for evidence. We'll continue to try to figure this out. And it's not that we have faith, particularly. It's that we have a good track record. It has been the case that, over time, unanswered questions in science get answered. It's quite interesting to sort of look back at some of the early things that creationists would point to as unsolvable problems, and then the scientist comes along and they figure it out, and then those unsolvable problems have an answer, and then creationists quietly move on to some other unanswered question. Where do they get those unanswered questions? Usually from scientists themselves, who are quite ready to admit that there are things that they don't yet know. That's what excites a scientist. It's a puzzle to solve, something to sic your graduate students on. And the view that they have is not one of faith. It's one that says we have a method and we have a track record. the likelihood is that given enough time and enough hard work, we'll make progress on this. It's not we're going to answer every question. I don't think any scientist expects that. There's going to be plenty for us to do for millennia to come. But we have good reason to think that we will, little by little, answer questions that it now seem to be insurmountable. History shows that we can surmount them.
Well, I was hoping to address, it's so tempting for me to simplify things, and I'm hoping you would address this. Maybe it is overly simplified. Do the two groups differ in their ability to live with present uncertainty or incompleteness? Are we dealing with one group that has to have everything neatly organized and answered because they're uncomfortable otherwise, and another group for whom uncertainty is just part of a step-by-step process? Would that be oversimplifying the two points of view?
That's a very interesting point there. What I was saying in just my last comment was addressing the second point with regard to scientists, that I think they live with uncertainty all the time and expect that. The whole basis of scientific reasoning is probabilistic evidence, and one never expects to get certainty, absolute certainty. Even the best conclusions are always, in principle, falsifiable. At some point, though, we get so much evidence that we think, well, this is just true. We don't expect it to be overturned. We take it as fact, and we move on to a new question. But uncertainty is always a part of the scientific approach, and what we try to do is have some measure of our uncertainty. On the creationist side, though, what one sees again and again is a longing for certainty, that answers as presented in really their religious faith and their religious texts are of such importance that if any of them are called into a question or appear to be called into question, they think that the whole structure will collapse, that Christianity as a whole will crumble should there be even one mistake found in the Bible, for example. Many creationists will say that quite explicitly. And that, I think, might reflect what you're pointing to, that there is sort of a difference in attitude on just this point about expectation of the answers written down in God's words, absolutely, versus the answers that a scientist looks for, which are really quite different, based upon evidence in the natural world. And as I said before, scientists may also have religious faith, but that's a different matter.
Well, thank you for letting me take so much time.
All right. Well, let's go to line number two. This is another caller, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if there's enough time for this line of reasoning, so I'll throw it out, and then I have a sort of a simpler question, which will also allow you to characterize some of the opposition, the proponents of so-called intelligent design. But science is a human endeavor, and a scientist writing a grant in his grant writing mode is fairly certain of or demonstrates some certainty in its paradigm, and it's a large philosophical endeavor to try to unpack all what that means. You know, the whole idea of the determinist Newtonian universe, promoting a mechanistic view of the world, et cetera, which has been undermined by probabilistic quantum mechanics, et cetera. I don't know if people are treating that in and around your arguments, but I think there's certainly something to be said there. But I wanted you to react to this, what I find rather ironic, that one of the funders of intelligent design theory is this guy George Gilder, who is sort of a free market fundamentalist who made a lot of money, you know, during the dot-com boom, talking about, you know, in very, you know, incredibly hyperbolistic ways about science and the coming millennium of electronics, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see his handiwork in funding the websites and dumping a lot of money in this?
Gilder was one of the early advocates of this view and a co-founder in a way, in the sense that he did help do some of the fundraising for the Discovery Institute, which is the main intelligent design advocacy group up in Seattle. I heard Gilder speak recently, actually here in town. He was invited by a conservative, political conservative club, and his topic was intelligent design and how evolution supposedly was falling apart. And it was a very interesting talk in that he spent really the first 45, 50 minutes of it not talking about that at all, but really talking about feminism and all of the problems that the women's movement caused. And the focus was on the social issues that he saw as really, he saw them as pernicious. And the Discovery Institute, in a leaked document, it's known as the Wedge Strategy, which lays out their plan for taking over the materialist worldview and putting in place a theistic science of intelligent design. They explicitly talk about this in terms of the social consequences, or the alleged social consequences, of materialism and evolution in particular. So I think that's something perhaps that you're alluding to that's important to bring out here, that this is not really just an issue even of religion generally, so much as a particular view that says the secular scientific worldview needs to be overturned because it's led to moral chaos, it's led to relativism, it's led to, they claim, abortion and pornography and divorce and homosexuality. They blame evolution for these perceived social ills and evils. And that's the reason, they say, we need to overturn evolution, because it's the linchpin of this modernist worldview, and what we need to do is return to a worldview that has God as its basis, God as creator. And Gilder himself, I don't know that he puts that much money into this anymore, although he made a lot of money in the .com. He also lost money when it busted, and his investors lost lots of money as well. In fact, they sued him because of that, I believe, so he does not have great resources to put into this himself at the moment, I think. But the folks who are funding it, the Stewardship Foundation, for example, they are folks who advocate Christian Reconstructionism, to say that this is a Christian country in its founding, it ought to be based upon biblical principles, and that's really what's behind this. They want to have a new moral basis to the country that's built upon a Christian foundation. So that's where the money is coming from, primarily.
Calling it a wedge document is—I don't know if that was their word—but I was also wondering if you think that some of this is instrumentalist, in the sense that people are joining on the attack on so-called liberalism, and that this actually might have an overtly, or maybe a covertly, political dimension as well. I don't know if there's any way of knowing that. That's looking into people's minds, I guess, and deciding whether they're how sincere they are about it or not. The other point that I started out with was this idea that science is a human endeavor and that it should be subject to criticism, and that like I said, people do become rather certain about their particular views, and then they're supposed to compete in the marketplace of ideas. But we know that's also kind of a construct that kind of falls apart as well. But so I'll let someone else go. I just note that, you know, this whole Ann Coulter thing, one of the first, not commented much, but I guess her first chapter is some sort of attack on evolutionism, though she doesn't actually say she's an intelligent designer, but that that maybe she's allergic to the word or something.
No. She's far more explicit than that. It's about almost a third of the book is a criticism of evolution and a pro-intelligent design view. And, in fact, she explicitly credits in her acknowledgments some of the people who've already been referenced here, Michael Behe, for example, but essentially several of the leaders of the intelligent design movement. And they themselves have, on their blogs, sort of trumpeted their involvement in her book. William Dembski, for example, says, you know, I'll take the blame for anything wrong in her book, because I essentially was responsible for helping her with this. So she really is quite explicitly taking their standard line. There really isn't anything new there. It comes quite from their playbook.
Let's get at least one more caller here. Next is Urbana Line 3. Hello.
I don't think religion is a good solution to our philosophical and moral problems, but so I'm not really on that side of the argument, but I hear you saying that if the ID people focused on the origin of life itself, evolution wouldn't be able to contest their positions at all. And I know when I've read a little bit of what they've written, again, I don't hear a good answer to the question. One of their basic questions is, how do you determine design from the artifact at all? You know, it's very similar to the question of how do you prove intelligence in other animals? So I wanted to make sure you would agree that if the ID people focused on the origin of life itself, there'd be kind of an impasse here. The whole thing seems to me like, on the one side, the scientists are saying, hey, look, we're going to stick with natural solutions to the problems we see. And the ID people and the religionists are all saying that, no, we've got to, you know, admit that there could be a non-natural intervention here. And that's really what the whole thing boils down to me, and I'd like your response. I'll hang up.
Yeah, the ID view is not just that we should admit the possibility of a God, a transcendent designer, but rather their claim is that you need it, that the only way to produce biological complexity is by a transcendent, non-natural being or power. Okay? So it's not just, you know, let's leave ourselves open to the possibility. Scientists, on the other hand, will say, we're going to do science. And what science does is look to the evidence in the natural world of natural processes, because there isn't any way to test transcendent, supernatural processes, and we're going to limit ourselves to those things that we can test. That rules out appealing to miracles, rules out appealing to God. But as I said before, that doesn't mean that a scientist can't be religious or can't believe in supernatural beings, or even can't say, who knows, maybe there is some supernatural being who had a role. It's just that that's not science, and we can't include that in our views. So it's really scientists, when they're speaking, I think, carefully, who would be the ones to say, we can allow the religious believer to hold such a view. I mean, that's certainly possible. We have to be neutral on that. It's rather the ID folks who are saying more conclusively, no, it must be a transcendent being, because it's not possible to have these sorts of complexities without it. And that's the part where one can simply say, look, this is simply a God of the gaps argument, and that's been objected to from the side of religious believers as much as anyone else, to claim, for example, with the origin of life, that science doesn't have an answer to that. You know, that's fair. We could be quite forthright as scientists and say, look, we admit we don't yet know. That's a very tough problem. But to say that this gap in our understanding is filled, is reason to think that God did it, opens one up to problems theologically. The reason theologians don't like this sort of an argument is, we mentioned indirectly before, that gaps get filled. Science progresses. And if you think that God only resides in the portions of our understanding that have holes in it, what happens when those holes get filled, when we get an answer to an unanswered question, God gets forced out. And that's called an argument from ignorance. And theologically, it's problematic because it makes God retreat further and further as science progresses and fills these holes.
I think that's
again something where, from both sides of the aisle, the scientific and the religious side, there are problems with the ID view.
Yeah, we're just about out of time, and I do want to ask one question. And unfortunately, I got to hold you to about a minute response. But
okay.
The question is: it seems that many biologists just don't want to be drawn into this debate. Do you think that scientists have done what they should to sort of step up to the plate and to try and explain scientific method and the idea of natural selection, and that, in fact, that they haven't done a very good job of that?
In the past, I think that was true. Whenever this controversy came about, scientists said, this is just nonsense. The arguments are bogus. We don't want to waste our time with this. And really, they just ignored it. But because of cases like Kansas, cases like Ohio, where it has become politicized and real science education is threatened, scientists, I think, have woken up and realized that this is a problem. And I actually now see within the last couple of years scientists taking this as a political issue that they do have to take seriously. There's 70-plus now scientific societies that have explicit statements saying intelligent design creationism is not science. Evolution is well supported. It should be taught. There is no place for creationism in a science classroom. That's a sign that scientists realize that this is something that they do need to be involved in. And I see now societies and individual scientists beginning to step up to the plate in that. And that's all to the good.
All right. Well, there we must leave it. Robert Pennock is professor of history and philosophy of science at Michigan State University. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for his book, Tower of Babel, The Evidence Against the New Creationism. Professor Pennock, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.